Welcome to Season 3 of Snubs and Dubs, where we're talking the snubs and the dubs of the 74th Academy Awards for Best Picture. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Kyle Tobias. And Kyle, how you doing?
A bit croaky, yeah.
A little froggy fresh over there.
I'm happy that you are full-voiced and able to quarterback that intro because you did a great job.
Oh, thank you. You know, we've been swapping back and forth in illness timelines. I was sick as all can be earlier this week when we were originally going to record, and then we kicked it back down to the weekend where we normally do it, but a little bit later. And now, unfortunately, your voice is a little bit swampy and of the frog nature, but that's okay because you're sounding fine and you're looking better.
Well, great. I feel great, like physically and like sinusly. Yeah. Feel fine. It was just that on, I think Tuesday was when I really got that kind of like cold, flu, whatever it was. And then I had an event on Thursday and I was recovering from that cold at the time. And so like my throat was still kind of like, it was still kind of like in that sort of sensitive area. And so all the talking that I did on that Thursday, it just fucking just pounded down on it. And so ever since then, I've just been kind of trying to recover. But Friday, I texted you. We weren't recording on our usual Friday time anyways, but I texted you in the morning and I would send you a video. I was like, I sounded awful. I could hardly speak.
For the listener out there, Kyle sounded like dog shit. Yeah, it was atrocious. I didn't like the noises coming out of my speaker when I listened to that.
So this is the best I've sounded in several days.
We're happy to have that. Kyle, have you watched anything since the last time that we've checked in?
Oh boy, did I ever. Ooh. I've actually been doing a lot of new movie watching. I went and saw The Menu, and it was a lot of fun.
Really?
That's good. Like a quick, easy little kind of a black comedy thriller sort of thing. I didn't expect it to be as funny as it was. It was actually quite funny. And it was a lot of commentary on class and like really upper class, like fuck you money, one percenters. And kind of their impact on food and how the people in the food industry are like dealing with that sort of culture. And it was so fascinating and so funny and so tight, like so tightly written. And it was just like it was kind of just 90 minutes, I think, which is perfect.
Beautiful.
And it was just really snappy, really well written. The characters were awesome and so funny. I would recommend it to anybody. It was like a lot of fun. Yeah.
Well, that's good to know. Like, I was curious about that one because they had like kind of intriguing, like before other movie trailers where it was kind of like, don't have your phone on during the movie. And I'm like, is this a movie or is this telling me not to have my phone on? But apparently it's a good movie.
It is a damn good movie. Yeah.
It's good to know.
Ray Fiennes is so good. And even Anya Taylor-Joy and Nicholas Holt are really funny in it. And it's got John Leguizamo, which how can you go wrong?
Yeah. Great start.
The other two I saw Glass Onion, The Knives Out Mystery.
And does it live up to the hype of the first one?
Yes.
Good.
I liked it about as much as I liked the first one, which is saying a lot because I really liked the first one.
God, that's all you can ask. Yeah. Like, you're not going to beat the original when it was that beloved. No. And I'm always scared of when a movie catches fire like that. And then like, well, we got to order seven more of these because I assume the quality is going to drop off. But I'm glad they held it up because I was kind of scared that they were just going to keep pumping these out just because they had the reception and money making power of that first one. But hell yeah, Glass Onion. Glad to hear it.
And I'm glad they put it in theaters for a bit instead of, because it is like Netflix bought the next two, like this one and the one after from Rian Johnson for a ridiculous amount of money. And so it was just going to go straight to Netflix and it will be going to Netflix probably by the time this episode's out. I think it'll be in Netflix this week or the week after. But they did a little theatrical run and I'm so glad because it was so fun to sit in the theater and watch this movie with a crowd because the reveals are great and the cast is hilarious and the characters are so well realized and it takes place during the pandemic, like deep 2020, like people are separated. You know, it's like we're not supposed to be having gatherings and yet they're inviting these people to this private island to have this private gathering. But they also use the pandemic to kind of give you insight as to who these characters are. Like one of the characters, this is super early, so I don't really consider this a spoiler, but one of the characters is having a party when they get the call for this invitation. And so like you immediately know that she's got no regard for anybody but like herself.
Yeah.
Right. And so
and like, the life of the party. Yeah. That's the most important life we need to care for.
And it's funny because like there's definitely parallels to real life people. Like Dave Bautista is clearly playing like a Joe Rogan type.
Oh yeah.
And Edward Norton is kind of like an Elon Musk type where he's just like stupidly rich but also stupid.
Oh and nice. So
like it's really funny and I really like how the mystery unfolded. Especially when like in Knives Out, you kind of get, you know who did it early on, but you're also trying to figure out other parts of it. Mm-hmm. And this, like, it kind of like is kind of holding your attention and your curiosity until it gets to a point where all is revealed. But then once all is getting revealed, like it actually takes a good amount of time and it's really well done and well paced. And I really liked it. I think people should check it out for sure. Especially once it's on Netflix.
So oh yeah. I was kind of weird. Like, I'm glad they did the theatrical release, but when I heard that it was coming to streaming like a week after it was out, I was just kind of resigned to just watching it at home. Totally. In my PJs, and I was fine with that.
Easy watch. Definitely. And the last thing was I saw She Said, which is kind of one of those Oscar type movies coming out. It was about the two journalists from the New York Times that took on the Harvey Weinstein story.
Oh, fuck that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good
and
for them.
So it was really about the two people that said, fuck that guy. And,
yeah. Nice. Yeah,
so it was really interesting. It was rapidly paced. Like, I had to go to the bathroom like 2/3 of the way through, but I was like, I can't, I'm going to miss stuff. If I like, even though you know how it ends up, like I really was interested in how this was going along, because there's a whole bunch of hiccups along the way. And like a lot of these girls had signed NDAs and contracts to say they wouldn't speak out about them, basically bound to silence and had their like voices taken away from them because of his oppressive power in the industry. And these two women tried to get all the evidence and as many pieces as they could and try to get as many of these women to jump together that could as they would. And finally got together with this piece that took them down. It was almost documentary like. It's a journalist movie. And so sometimes you think it's about the characters and trying to solve trying to get the case together, but it really wasn't like an acting showcase for Michelle Williams or I'm forgetting the other actress's name. It was mostly about them trying to put this together. And it's really just following the timeline. Mm-hmm. Like it really is just kind of like a chronology of events. Like it wasn't really narrative in a sense. Like it does have a complete arc where they're starting to figure things out. Things are getting difficult, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then finally at the end, things all work out. But like, it was really just like, this was what happened all the way to the end. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that because it is no bullshit. Like, it's just straight to, but at the same time, it like kind of felt not like a movie in a way. Mm-hmm. It was strange, but like, I did really like it. I just don't know how far it will go on the award circuit because I don't know how much you can get behind it.
Yeah.
Because it was just really a telling of events and there wasn't like necessarily a performance or that much kind of, I don't want to say like lack of creative vision because there was clearly a lot of thought that went into the telling of this story, considering the subject matter. It's very touchy. And so like,
oh, he's very touchy. Yes.
Yes. But like, so you had to do this kind of delicately, but like did appreciate kind of how they went through it. But it's not like a big kind of narrative emotional movie in that sense. So
Well, when you're basing it on Harvey Weinstein, he's already so cartoonishly vile that like you don't need to put a story into why he sucks. He's just an awful human being who's a dirtbag.
Totally. Yeah. And the last thing I watched was the Guardians of the Galaxy holiday special, which just came out on Disney Plus. It's fine. It's just easy. 45 minutes and that's it. Yeah. I wouldn't say it's anything that special, but
It's a holiday kind of special, so that's probably about it.
Yeah. It was nice. It was a fun little 40 minutes. I doubt I'll return to it though.
Yeah. I don't think they make holiday specials for their like ability to replay within the year.
Yeah.
Maybe like next year you'll be feeling it again. You're like, oh, I want to see Groot in a Christmas sweater. I'm sure that happens at some point.
No.
Or, oh, right, never mind.
But you see Drax in a Christmas
sweater. Hey, there we go. I knew someone would be wearing one. Oh, I like the idea that in this world where there's like all these different gods of varying powers and people who rule the universe, that the story of Jesus dying and his arc still exists canonically. Yeah. There's still Christmas.
Well, it's funny because it kind of the whole story is about how Peter Quill hasn't really had a Christmas since being like kidnapped and taken away from Earth. And so they're trying to like make a Christmas for him, even though nobody really knows what Christmas is. Mm-hmm. And so they're just trying to replicate what Christmas is so that he can kind of have a Christmas experience.
Oh, that's fun.
Which is like kind of sweet, but so it was all right.
Yeah. That's cute.
What about you?
I've only watched one movie, I believe, but I took a look last night and watched Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Nice.
Yeah. It was very good.
Yeah.
It was a lot different than I thought because we had recently watched The Banshees of Inisherin.
Yeah.
I think it is. Same director whose name escapes me, of course. Do you remember
Martin McDonough? Something McDonough?
Yeah.
I think so.
But yeah, I wanted to watch that after watching Banshees of Inisherin. And they're very different movies. I was surprised by how kind of opposite they are, because Banshees of Inisherin is very, like, not plot-wise heavy. It's just about one relationship and the back and forth between that. And then Three Billboards is a very heavy, dense plot. A lot of things happen to a lot of different people, and it's a very involved kind of, like, it's a thick plot, whereas Banshees of Inisherin is kind of thin, and then they kind of fill it out with the characters. But this one, like, you don't get as much characterization. You get, like, a bunch of different stories and different arcs. And I found my only issue with it was that it was all kind of, like, not quite overplayed, but a lot of the arcs that they gave to characters are kind of stock. Like, you have the racist who goes through personal growth to be a better person and help people. You have the grieving mother finds her way to, like, a healthier relationship kind of thing. Like, I did like the characters. It's just that a lot of them didn't feel that unique. So I think I was also kind of coming to it expecting, like, the same character depth that the Banshees of Inisherin had, which there's only, like, three characters who really have a lot of talking. So it's hard to do that. But overall, still very good and very worth watching. It just wasn't quite what I expected it to be, but I did enjoy my time with it.
Good. Awesome. Yeah. Is that it?
That's all I've watched.
All right. Well, other than that, we watched this movie. Of course, season 3 of Snubs and Dubs is covering the films from the year 2001. And so for episode 17, we are talking about Mulholland Drive. Had you seen it before?
I've never seen it before. I've heard a lot about it, didn't know anything about it. And I realize it's because no one knows much about it. You can't. So I didn't go in with much knowledge beforehand, although I thought roads would be more important than they were. That's the only thing. How about you, Kyle?
I hadn't seen it before. I only knew it kind of in the context of David Lynch's filmography, but I also didn't know really of it. Like, I didn't know what it was about. I didn't know any kind of plot or characters that was in this movie. I was pretty much completely blind other than the David Lynch of it all, which is going to kind of imply maybe like a weird sort of narrative. But then the only other David Lynch movie I've seen was 1984's Dune, which is not his best movie by any means. So I'm really like, I'm kind of virgin in the Lynch department. So this was kind of my real break into David Lynch.
Do we want to start hopping
in? Yeah, sure. If you were interested in Mulholland Drive, I've included links to the physical media related to it in the show notes. If you buy through that link, it'll help out our show. Or if you have any other Amazon shopping to do, follow the general link to help out our show in the process. Reminder, this is going to be a spoiler-filled conversation, so if you haven't seen Mulholland Drive yet and you want to, go ahead and do so. I've also included time codes in the show notes. You can skip around to your heart's desire. Without further ado, let's get into it.
Mulholland Drive is a 2001 surrealist neo-noir mystery film directed and written by David Lynch. This is starring Naomi Watts as Betty, Laura Harring as Rita, and Justin Theroux as Adam. This is a runtime of 146 minutes. It's a long boy and was released on October 8th, 2001. Kyle, hit me with your general thoughts as much as you can about this film.
It lost me.
Yep. It lost itself. Yeah. I don't know if anyone could be along for that ride. Yeah. It loses everyone at some point.
I was like, it was a little bit late when I was watching it. And I think because this movie has kind of a third act reveal, where
things, kind of
things like are supposed to be seen differently, and then you're supposed to reflect on everything you've already seen. I feel like because I wasn't really into the first two thirds of it, I couldn't really reflect that well. And so I was just kind of sitting there confused, like, what the fuck is even going on? That doesn't even look like Naomi Watts anymore. Like, is that the same person? I'm confused. Is it the person from the diner? Why is the person that was her landlady there and is Adam's mother? I was just lost. And it's obviously not until I looked up afterwards that I started to put the pieces together. But yeah, this was quite the experience. What about you?
Man, so the first night I watched it was the night that I started getting really sick and I wasn't enjoying it. I felt like every scene annoyed me for how long and drawn out every single interaction was. But I realized, like, I was getting pretty sick. Like, I started feeling bad. So I thought, like, okay, maybe I was just, like, not in the right place to watch that. Like, I felt pretty bad. So then I came back to it when I was feeling better to finish watching it for this episode. And I thought to myself, well, I'm just going to start it from the start. But oh no, I'm going to finish it. And then I'll just, like, rewatch some bits just so I can kind of remember it if I need. And then I immediately felt as frustrated at full health as I was when I was sick. And I know that it was not me or my mood.
Yeah.
I, this movie has some very good elements. I really like the dialogue in it. I felt like it had some of the best movie dialogue I've watched in some time. So I was really into that. There were some very enjoyable moments. I laughed and had a great time with that one part where the guy assassinates the other guy but accidentally like shoots through the wall when he's and like he shoots through the wall, another woman gets hit and she's going like and then he just has like this really funny like sigh, like when I drop a pen at work I would make that noise, and he just did that because he accidentally shot someone. Like, I thought that was really funny. But overall, I thought this movie was kind of annoying.
I did too, and it's funny because you know that it's really smart and it's like really smartly written, and there's so many layers to everything that once you know the ending and you go back and reflect, you can see where the layers were building. But I just think that because the experience through the beginning doesn't necessarily drive you to want to revisit unless you're like super curious by what you find out afterwards, it's just kind of like an odd feeling. Because I can appreciate what's on screen there, and what's on screen there is like really well crafted. Like, obviously David Lynch is a master filmmaker. And he's a master writer. Like, he clearly puts so much thought and care into each individual scene and piece of dialogue and how it relates back to what the actual experience is. It's just like, it completely lost me. And I think that it's going to take another viewing at least for me to kind of maybe start to appreciate this as a whole. But I don't know if I could ever get around to really liking it.
No, I don't think I can. I'm not even convinced I could be brought back for a rewatch of this one with how goddamn slick, just overdone every single part of it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I did enjoy some things, like that diner scene where the guy goes outside and there's that weird jump scare. I'll admit that was a really well done jump scare, even though I didn't understand why a member of the Uruk-hai has lost track of the Fellowship and is now in this fucking city. But there's so much of it that was a product of how it was made that I didn't watch any Mulholland Drive Explained or anything. I didn't want to. I wanted to go into this with just my thoughts, having seen it once, only experienced it in the linear viewing. I never went back to try and understand. I just sat down. I watched this movie once and then thought about that because I know that you were watching. You're probably watching something like that.
I watched Explained stuff.
So I thought like, okay, maybe one of us should go in with just a completely ignorant, wholly not understanding what happened there viewpoint, and then you can kind of have some picture of what was going on in the wild world of David Lynch.
Sure. Well, let's get into the plot and then we could talk about kind of the big reveal afterwards.
Let's do it.
All right, so I'm going to read straight to the plot. It's a bit long, but if you don't need the refresher, you can skip right to the discussion by following time codes in the show notes. But here's Mulholland Drive. A dark-haired woman is the sole survivor of a crash on Mulholland Drive, a winding road high in the Hollywood Hills. Injured and in shock, she makes her way down onto Los Angeles and sneaks into an apartment. Later that morning, an aspiring actress named Betty Elms arrives at the apartment, which is normally occupied by her aunt Ruth. Betty is startled to find the woman, who has amnesia and calls herself Rita, after seeing a poster for the film Gilda starring Rita Hayworth. To help the woman remember her identity, Betty looks into Rita's purse, where she finds a large amount of money and an unusual blue key. At a diner called Winky's, a man tells another about a nightmare in which he dreamt of encountering a horrific figure behind the diner. When they investigate, the figure appears, causing the man who had the nightmare to collapse in fright. Elsewhere, director Adam Kesher, who had his film commandeered by mobsters, who insists he casts an unknown actress named Camilla Rose as the lead. Adam refuses and he returns home to find his wife Lorraine cheating on him. When the mobsters withdraw his line of credit, Adam arranges to meet a mysterious cowboy who cryptically urges him to cast Camilla for his own good. Meanwhile, a bungling hitman attempts to steal a book full of phone numbers and leaves three people dead. While trying to learn more about Rita's accident, Betty and Rita go to Winky's and are served by a waitress named Diane, which causes Rita to remember the name Diane Selwyn. They find Diane Selwyn in the phone book and call her, but she does not answer. Betty goes to an audition where her performance is highly praised. A casting agent takes her to a soundstage where a film called The Sylvia North Story, directed by Adam, is being cast. When Camilla Rhodes auditions with the song I've Told Every Little Star, Adam capitulates to casting her. Betty locks eyes with Adam, but she flees before she can meet him, saying she is late to meet a friend. Betty and Rita go to Diane Selwyn's apartment, where a neighbor answers the door and tells them that she has switched apartments with Diane. They go to the neighbor's apartment and break in when no one answers. In the bedroom, they find the body of a woman who has been dead for several days. Terrified, they return to Betty's apartment, where Rita disguises herself with a blonde wig. She and Betty have sex that night. At 2 a.m., Rita awakes suddenly, insisting they go right away to a theater called Club Silencio. There, the MC explains in different languages that everything is an illusion. Rebecca Del Rio comes on stage and begins singing the Roy Orbison song, crying in Spanish, then collapses unconscious while her vocals continue in the playback. Betty finds a blue box in her purse that matches Rita's key. Upon returning to the apartment, Rita retrieves the key and finds that Betty has disappeared. Rita unlocks the box and falls to the floor. Aunt Ruth enters the room to find nobody. Diane Selwyn wakes up in her bed in the same apartment Betty and Rita investigated, where her neighbor informs her that two police officers have been looking for her. She looks exactly like Betty, but is a struggling actress driven into a deep depression by her failed affair with Camilla Rhodes, who is a successful actress and looks exactly like Rita. At Camilla's invitation, Diane attends a party at Adam's house on Mulholland Drive. At dinner, Diane states she has come to Hollywood from Canada, where her Aunt Ruth died and left her some money, and she met Camilla at an audition for the Sylvia North story. Another woman who looks like the previous Camilla Rhodes kisses Camilla, and they turn and smile at Diane. Adam and Camilla prepare to make their marriage announcement, but they devolve into laughter and kiss while Diane watches crying. Later, Diane meets the hitman at Winky's to hire him to kill Camilla. He tells her that she will find a blue key when the job is completed. The figure from the man's dream is revealed to have the matching blue box. In her apartment, Diane looks at the blue key on her coffee table when someone unceasingly knocks at her door. Distraught, she is terrorized by hallucinations and runs screaming into her bed, where she shoots herself. A woman at the theater whispers, "Silencio." But that's Mulholland Drive.
Well, Kyle, that was ever a plot.
Wow, it sure was.
Now, I have a question for you, and I wonder if there are any theories out here in the Mulholland Drive explains of the world. How did Betty have spare outfits and makeup for Rita? They wore different shades of lipstick. They are not the same figure. They could not share clothes, and it makes no sense why Betty would carry around a spare set of makeup for different shades than she wore. Was there any explanation for that online?
I mean, well, you could kind of chalk that up to the, it was all a dream.
No, absolutely. I will not do that. That is the I'm very mad that that theory has been brought forward, because shut up. It could have been a movie. Oh wait, it was a movie. There's no point adding another layer of like fiction to it. The universe has to exist for it to even be worthwhile.
So do you kind of have an understanding of what happens? Like, what's going on? Like, what is your coming? Okay.
Okay. So here is my theory. It makes sense as a story up until the point where they put the stupid key in the stupid box. And then at that point, David Lynch had to write an ending for the movie because he didn't have an ending for it. He wrote it as a TV pilot. So to make it a movie, he had to write an ending. So whatever happened there was whatever he decided to write to give it an ending to get a release. And I don't think he came in with a strong enough idea himself. And I would be happy to be proven wrong on that. Okay. But I don't think he knew what he was writing.
So yeah, as far as I understand, and I guess there is multiple different understandings of how you can see this movie, but once they open the box, Diane Selwyn, who in the dream is Betty, wakes up. Mm-hmm. And so in the real world, Diane, as I kind of mentioned in the plot, which you weren't present for, she came from Canada. Her aunt was dead. She got some money. She went on a set. She met Camilla, who is the Rita character in the dream. Mm-hmm. She and Camilla have a relationship, but Camilla also has a relationship with Adam, the director. Mm-hmm. Diane starts to feel that things aren't going well for her, that Camilla is kind of getting the opportunities that she's not, and that maybe she's sleeping her way to the top, and she's starting to feel discouraged because she's not going as far, and then also her lover is now gone. And so she orders a hit on Camilla, but she starts feeling guilty about it. And so she has a dream, which is the first 2/3 of the movie. Mm-hmm. Where she imagines that the hit that she ordered didn't actually happen because the hitman was incompetent, which is why we see him being such a bumbling idiot in that one scene where he accidentally shoots 3 people. Mm-hmm. That was the purpose of that scene, to kind of show his incompetence. So she's imagining that Camilla survived. She came to her, and then she is kind of the powerful person in that dynamic. She controls Camilla, which in this scenario is Rita. And so she is kind of taking her through and like essentially grooming her. Like there's a point where like she puts on the wig, they look the same. Mm-hmm. Like they have the same haircut and everything. And when she goes to the auditions, she's the one that's getting clamored over. She's the one that gets eyes from Adam. And even though Adam in this dream is confined to cussing Camilla because of some mobsters, which is another construction, because in the reality, it's not because of mobsters, it's because Camilla and Adam had a relationship. And that's why Adam wants the real Camilla in the role. But in the dream, she is essentially putting it so that Adam had no other choice but to cast Camilla because of some unforeseen mobster force. And so that's why she couldn't get the part. And like Adam has eyes for Betty. And then so eventually when everything kind of comes together, there's also slips of like Betty starting to kind of like Diane slip through. Mm-hmm. Like when they actually find out the name Diane Selwyn, like I think there's kind of like actual gaps of like Diane trying to like break that reality or Camille trying to break that reality. And then eventually when the key gets to the box, Diane disappears. It's like, now it's like she's woken up and now she's back in reality.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know what? I don't hate that.
Yeah.
Because there are at least some tie-ins to that. I just don't know if I like it. I was really hoping I understood less than I did because I followed through with like the surface level plot they present you of like up until the box and then the separate plot afterwards in like the quote unquote real world. Obviously, I didn't make the connections between the two that it was a dream, but I don't know. I don't know if that improves my movie experience because I feel like either I didn't have a chance to understand that, which is fine. I don't need to understand everything. But I also feel like it doesn't have consequence to what I watched on the screen, that it was a dream. And I think that's what bothers me.
Yeah, because like things seem weird at the start, but it's only once you kind of get that realization or like you're expected to realize that it is a dream that you start to put together that those were just fantasies.
Yeah.
And that they were like figments of this perfect ideal scenario that the real Diane was putting onto Betty and Rita. And so like, it's only in after knowing, and if you really put that together, that you get that full appreciation. And so I don't think that you can really say that as a complete movie, it necessarily all works, because unless you kind of put everything together and it doesn't necessarily give you all the tools to put everything together. It's like, it's strange. I don't know. There's a lot to it. It's incredibly dense. And I just wish I kind of liked it more. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. For some reason, this movie exists in the same place in my brain as The Room does, but for very different reasons. This was like a very competent, well done version of The Room where they were still locked into the same plot points and had to do the same shit. But they were given like an actual director who knows how to write a movie and it was well done. But it had the same ethereal feeling of something about this is not correct. Mm-hmm. Although I'd say for The Room, obviously many things about that are not correct. But it exists in the same uncanny valley of this isn't a movie that I am used to, but it is definitely a movie.
Yeah.
It just, even though I'm annoyed with a lot of parts in it, I don't even know if I feel like I should be. It's a whole different thing. I don't know. Like, I shouldn't have that expectation. And maybe there is a point in time where I'm in the exact mood to watch this, where I stop wanting a linear story that makes me feel good when they have a problem they overcome at the end of the movie to have their character growth and everyone gets happy at the end. Maybe I just need to watch this when I want to watch, when I need to watch something that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
But is a very well put, a very well crafted movie.
That's a very specific circumstance, I feel.
Yeah, I'm never in that, so I'm not watching fucking Mulholland Drive again.
It is a weird kind of movie to, I don't know, even just recommend. Like, you would have to be a big film nerd to really be someone that I recommend this to if you hadn't seen it before. Mm-hmm. And even then, it's like, you kind of have to preface it. Like, this movie take some time and some research and another viewing to really comprehend. And even then, like, you might not have the full picture of it. And there's obviously a place in the world for movies like that. I love that this movie exists.
Me too.
Because we need to have movies that challenge people and ask these difficult questions and ask you as the audience member to really think about what you just saw rather than just sitting through and just mindlessly drooling at a screen as it moves pictures through it.
Yeah.
But like there is a balance, I think, in still giving me an enjoyable experience while also asking these complicated questions and asking me as an audience member to grasp the reality of what I just saw. And in this case, I don't necessarily think it gave me an enjoyable experience until like I started thinking about it afterwards. I'm like, oh, okay, that's pretty cool. But like while I was sitting through it, I was just like numb. I don't know. It was, yeah. I was dull. Yeah.
This movie makes you work so much harder than you have for any other movie. And for that, I really appreciate it.
Yes.
And I can also, I will never recommend this to anyone. Mm, yeah. Mostly because socially, I don't have the movie clout to be able to. If I were to pretend to recommend Mulholland Drive right. to someone else, I would need to do an entire personality shift and pretend to be into like, what genre is this movie supposed to be again? Oh, neo-noir surrealist. I would need to put a beret on, pretend yeah. to have some kind of taste and live my life like that before yeah. I could actually recommend Mulholland Drive to someone. Mm. But I do like that. I very much agree with your point that I'm glad this movie exists,
yeah.
even if I never touch it or come back to it again. I yeah. am happy that David Lynch was able to make this and it exists out there in the world.
Yeah, this kind of falls into a similar place as Donnie Darko in a weird sense, because Donnie Darko also had that very confusing time travel narrative that it doesn't explain to you, but yet you still enjoy the whole movie and your progress through it. Whereas this is like, it's such a weird thing to sit through and you're like constantly kind of on edge and like, why are we in this scene with this bumbling hitman? Like, why are we here right now? And like, what is this weird mobster thing? I'm waiting for it to all come together. And then it does come together, but only in additional context.
Yeah.
And it's only when you understand that she's dreaming and she's making this shit up in her head so she can feel better about this fantasy that she's created instead of the actual reality of her life. That's why there's the crime lord. That's why this hitman's an idiot. That's why, you know, all these things are happening. That's why that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But like, it doesn't necessarily come together in the whole narrative. It's also really long.
Oh God, it's so long. I had to stop watching because I felt sick and wanted to go to bed.
Yeah.
But even if I was a full stamina, I don't know if I could have watched this all in one go. Yeah. Did you watch this all start to finish one
sure
set?
Sure did, yeah.
Oh, that's a challenge. It was. That's a marathon.
Yeah. There was a few pausing moments and relaxing for a moment. Like I think this movie requires breaks. Like it I don't does. Know if I could sit in a theater and watch this. It's
watching fun. This felt like I was writing a test. It had the same kind of mental like requirements.
Yeah.
And I do like the comparison to Donnie Darko because I'm very curious if there's a director's cut of this movie where like the 18 minutes of content that would have explained everything was somehow the only content that got cut.
Yeah. I don't know. Other people think?
Well, let's find out, Kyle. We're going to start off with Rotten Tomatoes, where they liked it, or at least said that they do. Okay. We don't have the cherries out. The critics give this an 85, and audiences are giving this an 87.
Okay.
So decently high. Mm-hmm. IMDb, 7.9, and Metacritic, 85. Mm. So this is a very highly, or I guess like a decently highly rated film. Yeah. And I wonder if people felt like they had to, or the credit card's getting revoked.
I kind of like was just thinking that too. I feel like this might be a movie that you feel like you have to say that you liked.
Yeah.
Otherwise people are like, what, are you just too stupid or something? You didn't fucking get it? It's like, no, I mean, I got it later, but I just didn't have a great time sitting through it. Like, what does that have to do with anything?
Yeah.
Give me a break.
It shouldn't be hard.
Yeah.
The box office was where this maybe showed more true colors.
Yeah.
It made $20.8 million on a budget of $15 million. So it came with a small profit.
Yeah. That's
not a big one.
That kind of makes sense in the critics too, because when the large majority of your audience, which clearly it didn't make a lot of money, are probably the David Lynch fans who know what they're getting into with this sort of experience. They're probably all for this. But I'm not surprised it did not do well at the box office.
Yeah, it made it to number 114 at the box office that year.
Yeah.
But time for us to get down and dirty with our scores. And I'll preface this by saying, you know what? I am stupid. I am too dumb to get Mulholland Drive. So I'm not scared to say that it's not my favorite movie. But Kyle, let's head it off with your enjoyment.
I gave this a 2.5. I don't know if I need to really explain that.
I think the first 20 or the last 18 to 20 minutes of our explanation probably did that. Yeah. I am giving this a 2. There were elements of it that I enjoyed. However, I felt like I was fighting the movie to watch it.
Yeah.
And I need to repeat that every single scene is too long and every pause between dialogue is too long.
Yeah.
And I just kept getting annoyed by it and wanting it to move along at some kind of pace. Kyle, what's your craft?
I actually gave this a 4. I think it is a very well-crafted movie, despite me not enjoying it very well. Well-directed, and the editing's really good, other than being a little bit slow, but
I'm right there with you. I'm sliding this down to 4.5. I think it was beautifully crafted. The writing, I really, really enjoyed the dialogue.
Yeah.
If you just cut out all the pauses between the lines, holy shit, this would be amazing. So I'm going to 4.5 it because I could not physically allow myself to give this a 5. Mm. Kyle, what's your execution?
This is a 3. I think the acting is really great. And obviously the writing is clearly well thought out. I just don't think it necessarily executed the full scope of it to a point where it felt satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
And so I commend the acting and I commend the effort of the writing. It's just like, it kind of fell flat for me.
Yeah. I'm giving this a 2.5 for this one. It feels weird for me to give this score. It feels like I'm trying to measure this thing on a 2D surface when it exists in 3D space because I can't capture how this movie made me feel, but the execution makes me want to give it a 2.5 and I don't have an explanation beyond that.
Okay.
What is your rewatchability?
Now, I actually gave this a 3 because I do feel like I might enjoy it on a rewatch now kind of knowing everything. And I am curious, but I'm not overly motivated.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it'll take a little bit of time, but I might return to it. So I think it's a 3.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to be giving this a 1.5. And it's because even though I am interested in rewatching it and learning more about it, I know that I can't.
Okay,
I won't have fun doing it. And if I try, I will give up and stop probably about 20 minutes in.
Yeah, that's
because
fair.
I put down every, like after the first 20 minutes was the first time when I watched it in the first go around that I wanted to stop. And then I recorded every time after that I wanted to stop. And I made about 7, I don't want to watch this anymore entries in this. So even though there are things pulling me back to it, I don't have the ability to rewatch Mulholland Drive in its current form. It's a 1.5.
All right.
Kyle, that is going to bring your score to a 12.5 out of 20 for a 63%. And that is going to bring my score to a 10.5 out of 20 for a 53%. Just going to give us to the ranking question, and it might be a tough one. Kyle, right now your ranking is Lord of the Rings, Donnie Darko, Memento, Royal Tenenbaum, Shrek, Training Day, Ocean's 11, Harry Potter, Sexy Beast, The Others, Black Hawk Down, Spy Kids, Monsters Ball, Gosford Park, In the Bedroom, Ghost World. Where is Mulholland Drive?
This is my new number 12, under Black Hawk Down, but over Spy Kids. As much fun as Spy Kids is, I do think that this is a better crafted movie. It is definitely more movie, just in the runtime and in kind of the overall scope of it. But I do think it kind of falls short of Black Hawk Down in terms of its complete sort of scope.
I think that's very fair. I am going to make this be my new number 13. Also just beating out Spy Kids because I feel like something about Spy Kids, I feel weird putting movies that are really well made below a children's movie unless I hated them.
Yeah.
So this has to go above Spy Kids. It is going to be my new number 13. Just below In the Bedroom. That is going to bring my ranking to Lord of the Rings, Donnie Darko, Royal Tenenbaum, Shrek, Training Day, Memento, The Others, Sexy Beast, Harry Potter, Ocean's 11, Black Hawk Down, In the Bedroom, Mulholland Drive, Spy Kids, Gosford Park, Ghost World, Monsters Ball.
Nice.
That is going to shift us right along into the fun Letterboxd review. Kyle, first of all, no Letterboxd heads out there.
Yeah.
What do you think this has on Letterboxd as its score?
I'm going to say like a 4 out of 5.
Very close. 4.2 out of 5. One of the highest that we will see from Mulholland Drive.
Yep.
I got a number of good reviews. People were putting in good work in the comments and I commend that. We're going to start off with Jace. 5 stars. I have so many questions after watching this. My main one is why was Billy Ray Cyrus in this? That was a goddamn jump scare.
That was awesome. That was so funny.
It was a really good decision. Yeah, that was a fun scene.
Yeah.
What I love about this movie is stretched into 150 minutes of me not understanding what happened are like little oases of just fun things that happened.
Yeah.
And goddamn, was that one of them.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Diana, 5 stars. this is the greatest movie ever made, I say, as I watch the Fifth Mulholland Drive explained video on YouTube and still don't understand anything.
Yep, that is the experience, yeah.
And Liam F. 5 stars, David Lynch may as well just change his name to David Lunch because it seems as though we'll always be hungry for more from him.
Oh, good.
Good for you.
Good little pun.
Yeah, I like that. I want to commend that kind of attempt at comedy in the Letterboxd reviews. It's fun. It's not trying to sound smarter than you are. Yep. Good work out there. And to wrap it up, I wanted to find one bad one just to see what people were doing in the dredges of Letterboxd. And Kai Dono, 0.5 stars, but a like. Didn't understand anything. Piss movie. I'm not watching it a second time to understand shit. Fuck you. And that really sums up anything below a 1 star was a lot of anger and resentment. Like this movie had personally caused them hardships in their life.
I feel like that and the 5 star with the watching the explained videos afterwards is the duality of two people in this movie.
That is,
they're either fucking hate it and they're not watching it again, or they love it and they're just going to kind of keep digging into it so they can finally understand.
Yeah, there is like, there's one coin, two sides. One side is, I didn't understand this movie and it humbled me.
Yeah.
And the other is, I didn't understand this movie. I'm not watching it a second time to understand shit. Fuck you.
Yeah.
For the Academies, this had one nomination for an Oscar.
Oh.
It was Best Director for David Lynch.
Yeah, that makes sense.
This won no Oscars, so it was not the Best Director for David Lynch.
Yeah.
Sorry, bucko.
I'm interested to see if, like, later in the season, if I would consider any of the actresses.
I thought Naomi Watts was phenomenal.
Yeah, she was really
She
good.
Would be someone I'd be looking at, but I don't. I mean, Laura Harding was also pretty good too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Maybe. Other notable awards. This was nominated for Best Music and Best Editing at the BAFTAs, winning Best Editing. This was also nominated for 4 Golden Globes, Best Motion Picture Drama, Best Director, Best Screenplay, and Best Original Score, but did not win any. This was also nominated for the Palme d'Or and the Best Director at the Cannes Film Festival, winning Best Director, sharing that with Joel Coen for The Man Who Wasn't There.
Oh, yeah. Movie we'll watch later this season.
I know, we'll be getting to that one. Yeah. So we'll see them. We'll see both sides of that chair. For interesting facts, this has a number of them. Adam Kesher smashing the producer's car windshield in with a golf club is a reference to the famous 1994 incident where Jack Nicholson committed the same act. Nicholson's nickname is Mulholland Man.
That's cool. I didn't know Jack Nicholson did that.
Yeah. I mean, if anyone would have, it would be Nicholson. So it checks out. Monty Montgomery, that's a fucking name.
Damn.
Who portrayed the cowboy, couldn't remember his lines. So Justin Theroux had to hold up boards for him to read off camera, which also explains because I don't know. At the time, I didn't realize it wasn't an intentional choice, but he doesn't look anywhere in particular, but his eyes move like he is reading, and that's why he was reading his lines, which he didn't have that many of.
That's funny.
Luigi Castigliani, that might have been close, the mobster who spits out the espresso on a napkin, was played by the film's composer, Angelo Badalamenti. That's cool. Kind of fun.
Yeah, it's a good little moment. Yeah.
He was really good at spitting. David Lynch originally wrote the basic idea for the story in the early 1990s as a spin-off of Twin Peaks.
Mm.
The character arc of Betty in the movie was written for Twin Peaks supporting character Audrey Horne, who would have been the central figure of the proposed spin-off.
Interesting.
So this section of interesting facts takes you into why this movie is the way it is and why a lot of the explained theory bullshit is just trying to paint what David Lynch had to do to make this movie into a choice that was made when it was kind of like a survival and getting this thing made.
Interesting.
Continuing on, this film was originally filmed in 1999 on a budget of $8 million as a made-for-TV pilot, Mulholland Drive. New scenes were filmed 1 year later on a $7 million budget given by the French film studio Canal to wrap up the open ending, which had been left unresolved in the original version so that a TV series could follow.
Oh.
Director David Lynch initially resisted Studio Canal's offer to provide additional funds to complete Mulholland Drive TV pilot as a feature film. Lynch's battles with ABC network executives had left him with a negative feeling about the project, and he felt he had run out of ideas for the storyline. When he finally agreed to revisit the film, he found that all the sets had been destroyed, much to his horror, And all the costume and props had been released by ABC. Normally, all sets, props, and costumes for possible TV series are carefully cataloged and stored for future use. Lynch claimed this setback actually proved a blessing in disguise, however, when it finally generated new ideas about how to proceed with filming, and he was able to come up with a satisfying conclusion to the story. So that was kind of the story journey, and that's why, like, at the end, they film it in places that weren't usual. Like, they didn't go back to Betty's aunt's house. They filmed it in Diane's
apartment.
Which they only showed like a little bit of before. And then it was other areas of that big house for like the dinner party because they didn't have any original sets.
Wow.
One last fun fact. This one bothered me. The Region 1 DVD of the movies does not feature chapters. Attempting to skip to the next scene or chapter takes you to the DVD logo animation at the very end of the movie after all the credits and ratings and so forth. Director David Lynch requested this himself as he has done on previous releases such as The Straight Story. By allowing the film to be on one chapter, Lynch believes people will be more inclined to view the feature in one sitting as intended. However, David Lynch, it's so goddamn long. This bothers me so much because you made a difficult to sit through movie. And then remove the ability to start and stop at ease.
Holy fuck. Because I just bought this new Criterion 4K of Mulholland Drive.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful looking 4K. But I stopped it midway through to just go like make whatever, have like a snack or something. And when I came back, I tried to get back to the chapter that I was at. And I skipped the chapter. There's no fucking chapters in this brand new fucking release.
Yep. He's requested they were removed himself.
This motherfucker.
I know. It's not that we're trying to piecemeal your movie, David. There are realities about watching things at home that are out of your control.
I just fast forwarded anyways.
Yeah.
So like it just made it more difficult for me to fast forward to get back to the point to resume the movie. What do you want me to do? Stop it and then restart the movie from scratch again? Like from the beginning?
Yeah. Would you watch this in one shot? Okay. You're not watching this, Kyle.
Jesus.
I'm glad you were actively affected by this because just reading this fact, I was annoyed.
Yeah.
And now we have a real world victim of what this stupid artsy stuff can do to just the logistics of watching a movie at home.
God damn it. David Lynch, you know how to piss a man off.
But that's all I've brought to the table for Mulholland Drive. Kyle, do you have any parting words you would like to leave Mulholland Drive with?
I don't know. I wish this movie experience was a dream, but it was more of a nightmare.
Very well said. I think your first statement there of, I don't know, that's how I'm going to leave this. Yeah. I fucking don't. Well, I want to thank you all for listening to Season 3, Episode 17 of Snubs and Dubs. As always, you can find us everywhere on socials at Snubs and Dubs. That's Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Letterboxd, Hive. We're also on Good Pods to make sure to check us out there and join our official Discord. We'd love to hear your thoughts on these films and on this episode, but Mulholland Drive, because we don't have many thoughts of our own. So please send us a tweet or a message with a question, recommendation, or anything else. I'm also at Windy_Mills on Twitter, and Kyle Tobiasen is at Kyle Tobiasen because he has a name where he can do that.
That's like my blessing. Like I love that. Sometimes it's like odd having a weird name, but like sometimes it's like so nice because I can just have my name be like any handle and nobody has it.
It's like reserved parking on the internet. Yeah. Whereas I'm fighting for the common space that I have to share with a million other Jason Millers. Of course, all the links will be in the show notes. Make sure to leave a 5-star review, share the show to everyone you know, and check back next week for another episode. Here's a sneak peek of the film we're covering.
Ladies and gentlemen, whether you like it or not...
Ow!
Hedwig!
Don't you know me, Kansas City? I'm the new Berlin Wall! Try and tear me down!
How did some slip of a girly boy become the internationally ignored song stylist barely standing before you?
Damn, handsome. I can't believe you're not a girl.
Looks like we got some sugar daddies in the house.
You could give me a cavity, honey.
Now you're interested, huh?
Not itch.
That's right. Next time we're talking about Hedwig and the Angry Itch. So make sure to watch it before the next episode. I can't wait for you guys to hear it. Thanks for listening. That's a wrap.
Bye for now.
Bye.